favorite scary movie. Have you checked the children?
It's all for you!
We have such sights to show you.
Like, well, I mean, I walked into your apartment. It very clearly is. But even, like stores, I'm like, dude, yeah. You guys are marketing
you
this
shit.
You
are prepared. Yeah, I know. It's been, like, all my Hulu ads are just like, Christmas.
Yeah.
And this was, like, before I even went home for Thanksgiving. So I'm just like, oh, my God, guys, tone it down.
Dude, it's only the beginning of December.
Gotta get them early. Oh, that's so good. Okay. You ready?
Yeah, fuck it. Let's go.
Let's get started. Welcome back, everyone, to another episode of the Horrible People's Podcast. I am your host, the slowly decaying Alex Webster. With me, as always, Anthony Fuentes.
Decaying at a normal rate. Alex is, she has an illness, so yeah. It's significantly faster.
Yeah, it's significantly faster. We're also very on par with the theme. Happy Cronenberg Christmas 2019.
Yay, that's right. Cronenberg Christmas 2019. We're doing it again.
Finally.
We didn't have a bit this time, but whatever. They're too beat.
That's totally fine. We didn't need to because there wasn't an earlier rendition of this.
Yeah, that's right.
We're totally fine. No bit needed except for the fact that I am dying slowly. Very quickly.
Not an oxymoron.
No.
Not an oxymoron.
No. I thought that through. Welcome back. Happy Cronenberg Christmas. I know The Fly is one of our least popular episodes, but fuck you guys.
Yeah.
We're doing it again.
It's a good goddamn movie, so you should watch it.
Yeah, The Fly is a good movie. Videodrome, jury's still out on that one. I'm not sure.
It's
a weird one. We are covering 1983's Videodrome, obviously written and directed by Mr.
David Cronenberg. Cronenberg Christmas 2019. So, what?
Good Lord, what a weird fucking weird movie.
I know. This is among the strangest we probably ever watched.
I would put it up there with Eraserhead.
Okay.
Like, I think in terms
I
of
agree.
Like reality based type stuff, I would definitely.
You don't have to pitch me on this. This is true.
No, you don't have to convince me.
Audience, if you want, yes, if you watch both of those movies.
If you haven't seen Videodrome, it's an hour and a half. It doesn't feel like an hour and a half.
It feels like 2.5 hours, maybe?
Probably.
Yeah.
The pacing's very odd, but worth it?
Yeah.
Maybe? I don't know. For the art? I don't know.
Just sometimes I just had to look away. I had to.
Really?
Like bad.
Ooh. I will pick your brain about this.
Yeah,
later.
We'll get to all that shit because, geez, now even thinking about it, I'm going to toss up my fucking coffee.
Okay, so when he acquires a different kind of show for his station, a sleazy cable TV programmer begins to see his life and the future of media spin out of control in a terrifying new reality. Which, this is about as much as we're going to get out of an IMDb synopsis about a David Cronenberg movie.
Yeah, I mean, it has the beats.
Yeah.
Kind of.
Sure. It's kind of on the pulse, but not really.
Last sentence is like an hour of the film, but yeah.
Sure. God. Oh, my God. Anyway. So, the cast for this. James Woods is Max Wren.
Hades himself.
Oh, yeah. God. Debbie Harry is Nikki Brand. Sonja Smits is Bianca Oblivion. And Peter Dvorsky is Harlan, just Harlan.
Harlan.
Leslie Carlson as Barry Convex. And that's about it for our principal cast.
That's about all the cast anyways.
Yeah, except for Professor Oblivion.
Who's, which one was, I can't remember.
The actual old guy.
Oh, right, yeah.
It was directed, of course, by David Cronenberg. It was produced by Claude Heroux, Pierre David, and Victor Salnicki. And it was obviously written by David Cronenberg as well. It was distributed by Universal Pictures, and it came out on February 4th, 1983, so it was a Valentine's Day movie.
Oh, what?
Great movie to take your sweetheart to.
Baby, do you want me to pierce you? Like, while you're...
Jesus Christ. I totally forgot about that. Oh, my God.
Yeah, that was the first one I looked away at. That was one.
Really?
Yeah, I couldn't.
Oh my
I could
God.
Not.
Oh
like,
my
I
gosh.
Was like, I brought my Nintendo Switch out. I'm like, I'm playing Skyrim. I just bought Skyrim. I'm playing Skyrim. Don't need to look up right now. Oh. No, wait, it was Pokemon. I needed to catch some Pokemon.
That is hilarious.
Yeah.
I was just, like, watching, just like, what the fuck? Anyway, the budget was $5.9 million, and surprisingly, not surprisingly, it only made $2.1 million in the box office.
Only $2.1 million? Yeah. I'm surprised it made that much. And again, I don't hate the movie. I actually think it's a very good movie, but it is not mainstream in any sense of the word.
No, which is, and I think we'll talk about this kind of, sort of, briefly, but this is, like, one of the first and only Cronenberg films that ever got a lot, like, big studio backing.
That's of all films, huh?
Yeah, this is the one where they were just like, yes, we like where you're going with this. Also, it's a Cronenberg movie. I don't know where they thought this was going to go.
Yeah.
This is after The Fly, so...
Oh, see, he was so bankable after The Fly, though. Yeah. That's what fucked it up.
I mean, if The Fly had Universal Pictures backing it, then it might have been a little different. I don't know. But either way, they made it work regardless. So let's go ahead and dive into the plot. We're going to shake it up a little bit. I'm very excited to talk about the plot with Senior Fuentes.
Yeah, okay. So this was just as a disclaimer, I watched the movie and then had to watch a bunch of the analysis video of Videodrome, like a few. Ryan Hollinger had a really good one.
Oh, shit. I didn't watch Ryan Hollinger's. I meant to look up and see if he had done any.
Yeah, he did a Videodrome. It was three things in one. Tetsuo, the mm-hmm. Japanese one, and then Akira.
Oh, okay.
Which also has the main character Tetsuo in it. But it was all about body horror. And yeah, it was really good. Really good. Really
so
helpful.
So he talked about all three of them in one video?
In one video, yeah. Because there was a central theme running through, which is pretty nice. But, and if we're going to just tackle the central theme here, let's get to the plot first. So, Max Wren, played by James Woods, of course. Fucking awesome. Again, actually, I don't like him as a person now, but for a while, James Woods was okay.
Why?
He's a Trumper.
Oh, wonderful.
But a hard, hard Trumper.
Wonderful.
Look at his Twitter feed, dude. This guy's he's losing it. Losing it.
Love that.
But he was pretty cool here. Especially in these interviews, actually.
I love the interviews. There was a little something that was off, so maybe I was getting hints of that, but I don't know. Anyway, continue.
It's James Woods, yeah. Max Wren is president of Civic TV, a Toronto UHF television station specializing in sensationalistic programming. Displeased with his station's current lineup, which mostly consists of softcore pornography and gratuitous violence, Max looks for something that will break through to a new audience, which, yeah, this is the first 10, 15 minutes of the film, and it's him looking for pornography and getting good sources on
Yeah, he's talking to Japanese porn dealers.
Yeah.
He's going to weird seedy motels.
I like how it feels so established, too. They're like, oh, yeah, it's fucking Max. Okay, here's what I got for you, buddy.
And it kind of establishes his character and establishes that he is a seedy, seedy motherfucker.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very early on. So, one morning, he's summoned to the clandestine office of Harlan, who operates Civic TV's unauthorized satellite dish, which can interpret...
You got it, almost... Enter what, Alex? Intercept. What does it do to broadcast?
Intercept, if I mention I'm sick. Intercept broadcast from as far away as Asia. Harlan shows Wren Videodrome, a plotless television show apparently being broadcast out of Malaysia, which depicts the brutal torture and eventual murder of anonymous victims in a reddish-orange chamber. Believing this to be the future of television, Max orders Harlan to begin unlicensed use of the show.
Oh no, you don't use unlicensed anything. Besides in our intros, but in entertainment,
I think because it's so quick. I think we're good.
We're good on the pass. Yeah. For the most part. But I do like Harlan because he's the most AV motherfucker looking guy.
For sure.
They pick the ultimate fucking latte sipping. You think this is hardcore? Yeah. Huh? That fucking guy. He's an interesting character. He seems no matter what, he's I got an opinion. All right, it's not gonna work. he's a good guy. But I also like how in this first part of the film, they really do establish well. They get some of the pornography, and James Woods is just this is crap. Too soft, too sensual, what
they
is this?
They show the beginning of this pornography, and I'm like, what the fuck is going on?
It's just very abstract for a little bit, And then it's just like, okay, cool, titty time.
Yeah. Well, it, and I think, I don't, again, I don't know if it made it into the outline. If it does, well, I'll bring it up again. But there are certain, like, packages you can get, like, that came with the documentary that we watched.
Mm-hmm.
That they released the full pornography Apollo, oh, Dionysus, and
yes,
Samurai Dreams.
I remember that.
The whole thing exists. It's out there. And I'm like, what?
That's so weird.
It's
that's
very
so
weird.
Weird.
It's very weird.
So fucking strange. yeah, and then the actual Videodrome footage that he gets right here is like way, way brutal.
Yeah.
like, to the point where I'm just like, oh, this was supposed to be mainstream, and within 20 minutes, I think you've, like, isolated a lot of your audience already.
Yeah, for sure.
Max experiences a hallucination, the first of many. Appearing on a talk show, he defends his station's programming choices to Nikki Brand, a psychiatrist and radio host, and Professor Brian Oblivion, a pop culture analyst and philosopher, who will only appear on television if his image is broadcast into the studio, onto a television, from a remote location, which I thought was the most artsy fucking, like, oh, dude, okay, yeah, commentary, buddy. Like, yeah.
Well, it's so funny because it's just, like, if you think about, like, Skype interviews.
Yeah. Oh, that's true. It's wow. Fucking A. Good revelation there. I didn't even think about that.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that's totally what happens. Definitely a precursor.
Yeah, like, if you think about, like, how, like, Skype interviews now and how certain people, like, how you get to interview people from all over the world now because of, like, you mm-hmm. know, Skype and stuff. Like, I'm like, oh, this isn't, like, in the movie, it's set up to be weird. But if you yeah. actually think about it in, like, today, like, it's not that weird.
It's become a practicality.
Yeah, it's not weird.
Yeah, it's, again, this movie audience is pretty ahead of its time yeah. thematically. Like, way. Yeah. Remember, this is 1983. We don't have, like, internet, really. Yeah. Not commercially, at least.
No.
And, yeah, so Oblivion delivers actually a speech prophesizing a future in which television supplants real life. Wow. I wouldn't say television, but entertainment media is
sure.
kind of determining the narrative right now. So.
So, yeah. Yikes. Well, this movie's a little too real at some part.
It is, right?
Like, thematically. Hopefully no one gets weird stomach vaginas. I don't know.
I honestly wouldn't put it past a lot of the what's going on in the world. Who knows? Who knows?
Who knows? Anyway, Max goes once again to Harlan's office, where Harlan tells him that the signal delay, which caused it to appear to be coming from Malaysia, was a ploy by the broadcaster, and that Videodrome is actually being broadcast out of Pittsburgh.
Which goes to show once again that nothing good ever comes out of Pittsburgh. Sorry, Steelers fans, you're all horrible.
Yeah, no.
No, I can't say that. My bosses are Steelers fans from Pittsburgh. Okay, like 99.7% of things, not great. Ah, no one other person from there. Just Steelers fans.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Sorry, I'm come from a Dallas Cowboy family, so I have to throw that in there.
Your family are Cowboys fans?
Yeah, dad's from Texas.
Okay.
Yeah, big time. We got blue stars everywhere. So, yeah.
Interesting.
All right. Oh, man. Okay, so...
Well, this is where it gets fun.
Yeah, okay. Let's start getting to the weird stuff. So, Max dates Nikki, who is sexually aroused when he shows her an episode of Videodrome and coaxes him into having sadomasochistic sex with her while they watch it, which this is the piercing, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay. There's like a gnarly ass piercing scene that I don't like.
He's just piercing her ears, which is...
I don't like it.
I mean, okay, here's the thing. If you have a piercing fetish, go with God, whatever.
Yeah.
But do it safely.
Yeah.
Because this is not safe, nor is it, like,
no
one's doing it well. Or,
yeah.
Like, you know, like, there are safe ways to do this, from my understanding.
It has to be better than what's going on here, which is super, like...
He puts the needle in his mouth at one point.
Ah, yeah.
And I'm just like, this is not sanitary.
Not sanitary, no.
Like, I have problems... Britannia also has problems with it, so if you hear her in the background, she's clearly upset about
this. She's like, don't make me watch it again.
She was with me the entire time. I was, because also it was freezing in my apartment last night because those harsh California winters.
Harsh California 50 degree winters, my God. Oh no, it was probably like 40 something degrees. My bad.
No, I checked and it was like, it's 50 degrees. And I'm like, it said 55. And I'm like, you're lying.
Bullshit,
to me.
Dude.
You are
no.
lying to me. I'm going to freeze to death in my own apartment.
I doubled up on blankets and it wasn't enough. And it's like, I turned off all the fans and I'm like, I'm in a closed room. This is only my body heat here.
I had no fans, nothing. I do had to turn on my heater. Nothing worked.
I don't have a heater. I live in a warehouse. Oh, wait. Warehouse. Factory. With concrete walls.
Yeah. Brick walls.
It's an icebox.
Yikes. But anyway, so this scene is like really weird. Obviously, like Max is not into it. But
yeah.
He's kind of just like trying to placate Nikki, who is like clearly needs to work out her own issues.
Yeah, oh right, and she was getting like cuts too on
her. Yeah, she had like cuts on her neck and stuff. And again, go with God. Like if that is if that's your thing, whatever. But like you gotta, like, I don't know, put some Neosporin on that shit or something.
Yeah, okay. I'm like, those are too fresh, and that could get infected, sir. So maybe use the other shoulder.
Some bandages, Neosporin, like, take care of yourself, girl. Like,
she's like, this is the good shoulder. Like, fuck.
My God. Anyway, so the next time they're hanging out, hearing of the true broadcast location, Nikki excitedly tells Max that she plans to go to Pittsburgh to audition for the show under the guise of a business trip and presumably never returns. This is also where she burns herself with a cigarette.
Oh, yeah, huh?
Yeah. Again, what is she...
She's, like, the one taking the moralistic angle on the talk show, too, which is weird. So I'm like, do you just like being a, like, walking dichotomy? Is that...
Yes, probably. Also, I don't know. But I think for her, there was a lot. She was a very complicated, weird character. And I liked that about her.
I did like that
I wish we had more of that before she immediately jumped into, I'm going to burn myself with cigarettes to make a point.
Yeah, and then now I'm, like, not in the movie.
For, like, 90% of the movie.
Yeah.
So, that sucked.
I mean, it does give you the stakes, though. Like, she probably shouldn't have gone if the movie was still in this realistic context that it is right now. It lets you know that, hey... There's some shit going on with Videodrome.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. But the whole point of that was just, it was just interesting. And then Max is just like shaking her, just like, promise me you won't go.
Yeah. Because
like he's already getting heebie-jeebie vibes about the whole thing, so.
And is this when the hallucinations start like?
They've kind of started, but not like enough for.
Not extreme, huh?
No, just enough for him to be like. Something strange is afoot.
What color was my jacket again? Blue? Oh, it was fucking red. Okay.
Very curious.
Anyway, so Max contacts Masha, who was a very cool character, actually.
I love her a lot.
She's like this old sage grandma woman who's just like, like me some younger boys.
Yeah, she's like a porn producer or something.
But she has like this madam fucking like,
vibe
to
her. She has this really like graceful, like sophisticated madam vibe in everything she does. And I'm like, you are my favorite character. Thank you.
She needs like a long-tailed Cruella de Vil cigarette. Yeah. And that's it. That would seal her fucking deal right there.
She even had like the 1920s like cap.
The cap, right?
And that was great. Like she had like the fur coat. Like I was just like, damn, girl.
Like, dude, you're a G. All right.
I know. And he was just like, in exchange, you can shower with me whenever you want.
She's
and
like,
he's
bitch.
Just like, I know. And she's just like, you're a little old for me.
Yeah.
And then she winks at the fucking waiter, and I'm like, damn, girl, like get down with your bad self.
Yeah,
like,
no, she was cool. I wish we had more of her in here. But Max contacts her, obviously. She is a softcore pornographer as well, and he asked her to help him find the truth about Videodrome.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So through her, Max learns that not only is the footage not faked, so it's basically snuff.
Yes.
But that it is the public, quote, face of a supposed political movement. Masha further informs him that Brian Oblivion knows about Videodrome and is potentially behind it.
Mr. TV in TV. And I like this angle too, because it's like, listen, like a lot of this stuff is like, yeah, it's tantalizing, whatever, but this has an agenda. This has a philosophy behind it.
Yeah.
There's obviously more machinations behind it than you would think on the surface.
And philosophy is like one of those like big keywords when it comes to Videodrome. Like there is like philosophy behind it, and there's we'll get into it.
Oh yeah, it's a pretty interesting take on capitalism.
Capitalism.
Anyways, so Max tracks down Oblivion to a homeless shelter where vagrants are encouraged to engage in marathon sessions of television viewing. A good racket there. He discovers the mission is run by Oblivion's daughter, Bianca. With the goal of helping to bring about her father's vision of a world in which television replaces every aspect of everyday life. Yeah, he kind of has his dream right now a little bit.
Huh? I mean, everyone's just trying to get, like, more screens in front of them every chance they get, right? Like, we're even talking about, like, the Google glasses and all that stuff where, like, you literally have everything in front of you at all times.
And this is where this part where she reveals that, like, he is exclusively, like, videotapes?
No, not yet.
Okay.
I think that is a little later.
Spoiler alert.
Yeah. Also, if you haven't seen Videodrome, yeah, first of all, spoiler alert. Second of all, if you haven't seen it, just watch it. It's like $3.99 on Amazon. Just watch it.
And it's, but just, you know, watch it either alone or with somebody you know has a high threshold for some shit.
Don't watch it stoned. For the love of God, don't watch it high.
Oh, dude.
This is not, like, I am normally such an advocate of watching horror films under the influence. But, like, don't
do it.
Like, it messed with my barely concrete sense of reality. And I was stone cold sober the entire time.
I was a little high, but then I had to start switching over to booze after a while.
it was freaking me out because I was so uncomfortable. It was not a fun time.
I started off with like a fucking like a bowl and Videodrome, and then I had ended with three claws and a Nintendo Switch.
Wow.
Because so, there's sometimes I just had to look away. Like I was like, nope. Can't do it. Can't do it right now.
Later, after yet more hallucinations, Max views a videotape in which Oblivion informs him that Videodrome is a socio-political battleground in which a war is being fought for control of the minds of the people of North America. Now, I believe this hallucination is the one where we have, like, that weird gaping hole in his chest, and that's where he loses the gun in himself.
Oh, yeah.
Which was a weird one.
That is, yeah. That was...
It's supposed to be cognizant of a VCR, but I was just like, stomach vagina,
absolutely.
Cool.
I mean, it's just, there's an insertion aspect to it, obviously. But it's also, I think, the point in the movie where things, like, your mind gets fucked from here on out.
Yeah, from this point on, like, your sense of reality, there are sudden cuts, like things, like, suddenly go from, like, one scene to another, and, like, these weird cuts where you're just like, what is real, what isn't,
It's a lot like Perfect Blue.
Yeah.
It's a lot like Perfect Blue,
dude. Oh my gosh, yeah, totally. I was kind of thinking about that. Like Perfect Blue and Videodrome has those reality-based kinds of anxiety-inducing scenes where I'm just like, I don't know what's real, and it's making me anxious.
And, like, some stuff feels like it could be real, and then you realize that, like, this is all bullshit. Yeah. What's happening? Where are we at now?
Yeah.
What's the... Because it just removes the context from it and puts you in a whole different one.
Yeah.
Which is scary. It's actually pretty scary.
Also, that the gaping hole stomach vagina hasn't happened yet.
Oh, no?
He's had some hallucinations, but not that one.
Not yet.
I think this is the one where...
is it the TV moving?
Yes.
TV moving?
The TV's moving, and he sticks his... And he, like, fucks his TV. I don't know what it's supposed to represent, but...
Again, guys, maybe watch this movie and try to figure out what we're talking about here, because this is...
He sticks his face into a breathing television. I don't... And in the TV, there's, like, lips on the face. Lips on the TV. So I don't know what's happening.
And, like, I think this is just one of those things that the special effects have such texture to him. They look so organic sometimes. And it's, like, an artificial thing. So
We are gonna speak at length about special effects because the way... Again, this is just a David Cronenberg thing. But, like, the way he's able to take... the technological and make it look organic is eerie.
It's scary as shit, dude.
And disgusting. And, I fucking love body horror.
Yeah. And this, again, it's all being fought for the minds of the people of North America, where they say, like, oh, people are getting too soft over here and blah, blah, blah. Like, they need a little bit more edge. And I'm like, oh, that's one philosophy. But sure. you'll get the counter soon enough, obviously.
And then we get things like Killing of America, where I'm like, are we too soft? Yeah, is that really where we're at?
That was released around the same time as this. It all comes together. Again, check our Killing of America episode they mention Mondo in this.
They do.
They mention Mondo.
And it's people who watch Mondo who are the ones that like are watching Videodrome and becoming like slaves to the machine.
Oh my God. The fucking Flash. Okay. So Bianca tells him these are side effects, obviously, from having viewed Videodrome, which carries a broadcast signal that causes the viewer to develop a malignant brain tumor.
Dun, dun, dun.
Ew. Scary. Yeah, I don't... Cronenberg, as we covered in The Fly, which I hope you guys take the time to go back and listen to.
It's a good episode.
It's a very good episode. It has a relationship with... He has a very interesting relationship with conveying terminal illness in his
sickness
films.
And the grotesque and body horror and how that all kind of comes together. And
he's one of the few directors that really pulls it off, big time. But to my dismay sometimes.
Much to your uncomfortableness. But there's also something about his... he communicates with his special effects department so well.
He does. He gets his point across.
I don't know. It's great.
Hires the good people. Shit.
He does. I mean, we're going to talk about it, but he hired one of the greats.
Yes, absolutely.
For this movie in particular. Shortly thereafter, Max begins experiencing disturbing hallucinations in which his torso transforms into a gaping hole that functions as a VCR. Of course, we don't know this until later when people start actually putting VCRs in him, but it's all very sexual.
It is. It's played up for sure.
I think it's the most overtly sexual thing ever in this movie, except for the fact that his gun starts looking like a penis later.
This is so weird. Okay,
The psychosexual elements in this movie are insane. Freud would have had a fucking field day.
Oh my God, absolutely. Ugh. And the thing is, it's not a cheaply looking film either. Are some high tech special effects.
It is clearly intentional what they're trying to make this look like, right? I'm not the one with a dirty mind. Cronenberg is the one.
In that first VCR scene, there was a little samurai something over an erect penis.
Yeah.
And he just pulls out. And that's a pretty realistic looking penis coming out of a fucking table.
Yeah.
So that's what you're getting off the bat, and it just gets much crazier.
It's so weird.
Yeah. Anyway, Oblivion helped to create Videodrome as part of his vision for the future. But when he found out it was to be used for malevolent purposes, always bad, he attempted to stop his partners. They used his own invention, however, to kill him. In the year before Zeth, Oblivion recorded tens of thousands of videos, which now form the basis of his television appearances.
So, how wild is that?
I don't... what is even real? What is even not? This is the first bit of just reality. What is exactly a person?
And this is where, which you had brought up earlier.
Yeah.
He is
tapes.
Yeah, where he is tapes. And she hands him tapes. And
Bianca, right?
Yeah, Bianca hands him tapes and it's just you should ask my father. And it's four tapes. And I'm like, oh my God.
I like how James Woods is also yelling at the TV. And he's like, they're tapes, man. They don't know. They're not going to respond.
But then they respond. But then they fucking respond.
But it's the hallucination. It's weird. It's so weird.
But the hallucination are in the tapes. I don't know what's going on.
Yeah.
Because are they tapes? Are they Videodrome? Who knows? Mm-mm. So, anyway, moving on.
Yeah.
This is where it really goes. If you thought this was weird, from here on out, guys, it really just goes left field.
The third act is 35 minutes of just...
chaos.
Madness. Madness.
Absolute chaos.
Okay, let's go.
So, Max is contacted by Videodrome's producer, the Spectacular Optical Corporation, an eyeglass company that acts as a front for a weapons manufacturer.
So, such a good commentary on all this bullshit we live through here.
The head of Spectacular Optical, Barry Convex, which is such a good villain name, by the way, has been secretly working with Harlan to get Max exposed to Videodrome and to have him broadcast it as part of a conspiracy to give fatal brain tumors to, quote, lowlifes fixated on the extreme sex and violence of society.
So these are the moral motherfuckers.
Yeah,
right
this
here.
Is like the people who Well, and this whole thing was so wild because, like, the introduction of Barry is, mm-hmm. like, super sudden.
Yeah.
And it's kind of out of nowhere. And then you kind of, like, interact for a little bit. And then there's that whole helmet scene. This summary kind of yada yada us through quite a bit.
Yeah. And then we have, of course, our AV boy, Harland. I was a little sad that he turned heel.
I know. I'm like, you're evil?
I was like, dude, you're the most down-to-earth looking fucking guy.
I know, he was supposed to be, like, the guy in the chair. Like, he was supposed to be, like, the man to help Max.
Yeah, he was the...
But Max is a shithead, so it's
yeah,
fine.
That's true. That's a good point. anyways, Convex then inserts a brainwashing videotape into Max's torso. Okay. Under Convex's influence, Max murders his colleagues at Civic TV and later attempts to murder Bianca, but she manages to stop Max by showing him a videotape of Nikki being strangled to death. Ugh, yeah. Bianca then reprograms Max to turn against Videodrome. So he's like a vessel at this point.
Now keep in mind, the last like three, the last two bullet points and then this next bullet point is like the last 45 minutes of the film. Like yeah. They draw this shit out.
They do. It's a lot of, this is augmented by like, Max's handgun.
His handgun and him running around and him like debating what's real, what's fake, his own hallucinations.
He is having like a philosophical, because he doesn't just automatically be like, oh yes, kill. He's like, what am I doing?
Well, yeah, like, what is why this? Am I doing this?
That's a good idea. This is a bad idea. Fuck.
Yeah.
My hand is a gun now. Which
it looks like a penis.
It looks gnarly though when the wires are going.
Oh, when they go
it?
Into his hand, because I was just like, "Is that what they're gonna do? Is that what they're gonna do?" And then you see the wires are going through his hand, and I was just like, "Fuck yes!"
And they're thick ass metal rods. Cronenberg,
because again, the marrying of metal and flesh is such a Cronenberg thing, and I love it.
Oh, and it just straight up marks people. It's fucking,
I love it.
Fucking ugh.
On Bianca's orders, Max kills Harlan and Convex in really gruesome, brutal ways.
Oh, yeah.
Afterwards, he takes refuge on a derelict boat where Nikki appears to him on a television. She tells him he has weakened Videodrome, but in order to completely defeat it, he has to ascend to the next level and, quote, leave the old flesh. The television then shows an image of Max shooting himself in the head, which causes the set to explode. Reenacting what he has just seen on the television, Max utters the words, "Long live the new flesh," aims the gun at his head, and pulls the trigger as the screen cuts to black.
Yeah, that ending kind of came out of nowhere for me.
Ooh.
Yeah, it was,
any movie that ends with someone shooting themselves in the head, I'm just like, well, that's fucking depressing.
Yeah, this had such an interesting buildup, though.
Yeah.
Because, like, that gruesome ass, like, TV exploding and like it all like it just it's so sci-fi.
Yeah,
it's very sci-fi and I don't know, I'm just think well, about certain scenes.
This is a very sci-fi movie.
Yeah. And then James Woods actually acts pretty well, like
he's a good actor
thing. Yeah.
I will give him that,
absolutely. Yeah, anyway, so that's the plot right there.
That's the movie. I hope you weren't eating anything like oatmeal or chili or anything like that.
Or sheep guts.
Or sheep. Sweet or sweetbread. You know, you were eating anything like that.
Or whatever hot dogs are made out of. Yeah, that's...
Yeah, I mean, that's a mystery.
But yeah, this... Oh, fucking A, dude. I just can't get over just how fucked up this last... We're not doing it justice right now. You have to watch this movie.
Just watch it. Like, I can visualize it because I've seen it. Mm-hmm. But if you have not seen this movie, just reading what happens does not make, one, a lick of fucking sense. Two, it doesn't do the movie justice.
And, but just so you know, me and Alex are, because this podcast is going to live on past our regular flesh for all of eternity.
Yeah,
this is where the process starts right here.
Start a podcast, live forever.
Start a podcast, live forever. Oh, that was good. I like that was a that's a very good philosophy right there. Oh, okay. All right, guys. But in order, obviously, that's the plot summary. You know how this podcast works because you've been listening for a while, hopefully. And we have some production details to go over. See how this
finally
film was made.
Yes. We're out of the gross.
Yeah, yeah. So again, you need this context to know what you're getting into. So David Cronenberg recalled how, when he was a child, he used to pick up television signals from Buffalo, New York, late at night after Canadian stations had gone off the air, and how he used to worry that he might see something super disturbing and not meant for public consumption. This became the basis for the plot of Videodrome.
I cannot explain how many times I've had the same anxiety as a child.
What, like picking up, watching some shit you know you're not supposed to see?
Accidentally stumbling across something that I'm not supposed to see, picking up television signals, because as a child, it was a very tiny child, I had rabbit ears. So, like, picking up signals and stuff, and I understood how it worked, because I was super science-y and techie as a kid, so I understood what rabbit ears did. So I had this fear as a child that I was going to pick up something that I wasn't supposed to see, or that, like, or any time, like, I had walkie-talkies that I was going to pick up something I wasn't supposed to hear. Man. Like, when I read this, I was just like, holy shit, I get that, because, like, that's something that resonated with me as a child, that I was totally afraid I was going to pick up something, like, pick up something that I wasn't supposed to hear in, like, the evil kind of, not even something like, oh, the neighbors are having a conversation. Like, I'm talking about, like, listening to someone get murdered, listening to, like, crime happen, snuff films.
Yeah, some TV, like, shit you're not supposed to
see. Dark web shit, like, before I even knew what the dark web was, like, that kind of shit. So dude, I totally get that.
Dude, I wanted to, I wanted to find different stuff because I was like, I'm bored with what's on TV now. What is the stuff I can move the antenna around and figure out? I used to try
to. You sought it out.
I sought it out. I didn't find much, though. It was mostly like, oh, these are old cartoons that I've never seen before. That's about the worst I've gotten. Yeah, and some of them are in Spanish. So, but Cronenberg also gained inspiration for the film from one of his media professors at the University of Toronto in the 70s. So he's a real media-focused motherfucker throughout his whole life.
Yeah, I think at the time he actually went to school for, like, in the sciences. Mm-hmm. But then he ended up becoming a literature major, and then he also got inspiration from one of his media professors.
It's good to have intelligence in different, you know, aspects, because you can incorporate. Christopher Nolan is a director, too. Very sciencey guy.
Yeah.
James Cameron, same shit. But they are also artists. So Cronenberg is in the same kind of vein, but significantly weirder.
Oh, yeah.
Despite not having a finished script, though, shooting for the film began in October 19th of 1981. And that initial week of filming was devoted to videotaping various monitor inserts. Pornography. These included the television monologues of Professor Brian Oblivion, as well as the Videodrome torture scenes and the softcore pornographic programs Samurai Dreams and... Was it
Apollo and Dionysus?
And Dionysus shown in the movie, which are very absurd. These are very, very absurd, guys.
I love that because Apollo, I mean, you know, Apollo is like the god of the sun. Yeah. Like, you know, like, well, not the god of the sun, but like the god of like all this stuff. And then Dionysus is just like, is a god of like wine and like basically parties and being horny. So,
it's such a cool name for a softcore pornography.
It's great.
It's actually kind of badass.
It was very humorous to me, especially as a Greek mythology nerd.
Yeah. But three different endings for the film were actually put together. And the ending used in the final film, where Max shoots himself and on an abandoned ship, was actually James Wood's idea. One of the initial intentions for the ending was to include an epilogue after the suicide, wherein Max, Bianca, and Nikki appear on the set of Videodrome. Bianca and Nikki are shown to have chest slits like Max, from which grotesque mutated sex organs emerge. Okay. Yeah, I remember this in the documentary. It was, I'm glad they didn't go through with it. I don't know. No. I don't think that, it would have, I feel like, just been a bridge too far. As far as this movie goes.
Well, I know all the special effects people, like, set it up, and, like, they were gonna do it. And then Cronenberg was like, wait. We're going to wait.
Yeah.
And then they never did it. So.
Cronenberg described his original vision of the ending as follows. Quote, after the suicide, Max ends up on the Videodrome set with Nikki, hugging and kissing and neat stuff like that. Happy ending? Well, it's my version of happy ending. Boy meets girl on the Videodrome set with the clay wall maybe covered in blood, but I'm not sure. Freudian rebirth imagery, pure and simple. Damn.
Fucking A.
I like how he just rambles into like, just so you know, it was happy, okay? Like,
they buy as close to a happy ending as you're gonna get in a Cronenberg movie.
I love how he's just so normal too. Like,
oh yeah,
he's just like, yeah, no, dude, like the flesh gun. Like, anyways, in his director's commentary for the Criterion Collection releases of the film, Cronenberg credited his decision to omit the epilogue, at least partially, to his own atheist beliefs, as the apparent resurrection of Max and Nikki on the Videodrome set could be interpreted as their having gone to an afterlife, whereas Cronenberg himself does not believe in one. So, oh, there you go. Pretty clean reason as to why he didn't get weirder. David Tsubochi, who appears here briefly as a Japanese porn dealer, later became a minister in the Ontario provincial government. Okay. His appearance in this controversial film as a pornographer was exploited by the opposition, but hey, I'm glad he fucking won.
Right.
I'm glad he won. Beat those fucking
assholes.
Not moral. Look at this guy in a Cronenberg movie. People are like, yeah, he's in a Cronenberg movie. Let's vote for him. Fucking 90s. Anyways, David Cronenberg had to actually double James Woods for the scene in which Max has a helmet put on his head because Woods was afraid that he might be electrocuted by said helmet.
Fair.
I James Woods. Yeah.
Fair.
Yeah. He's like, I'm a star, man. Just put some other asshole in there.
Someone else can get electrocuted, not me.
Yeah. It's you don't see my face.
Yeah.
The videotapes used in the film, at least as key props, are Betamax format. This is because VHS cassettes were too large to fit into the false stomach for special effects scenes, which we'll now get into because holy shit.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then Betamax obviously lost that war.
Yeah.
So. Movie's not ahead of its time as I thought it was, huh?
They tried.
Yeah.
So, special effects.
I am
thrilled for this. So, if you are interested and you kind of want some supplementary material and you have about 30 minutes of free time on a Saturday,
mm-hmm.
I recommend Forging the New Flesh. It's a documentary.
It's a very good documentary.
Yeah, it's a documentary on YouTube and it kind of goes into all the special effects. It's to the Criterion Collection as well.
Mm-hmm.
And they kind of go through the special effects and what the timetable looked like and all that stuff. So I got mm-hmm. a lot of material from the episode from that.
Yeah.
So it's some of it will be repetitive, but there's also a lot of stuff from there that I couldn't put in here just for time constraints because we'd be here all day.
Yeah, exactly. It's a pretty comprehensive look for 30 minutes, surprisingly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They cram a lot in there for 30 minutes.
They definitely do. And they got some great interviews with like the key people who got this shit done.
Yeah. So we can attribute the terrifying, iconic, and grotesque special effects makeup to practical effect legend Rick Baker.
Ooh.
Who, if you are not a super special effects nerd like me, won the very first Best Makeup Academy Award for an American Werewolf in London.
That transformation that they showed, Jesus fuck, dude. Rick Baker knows his shit.
Yeah, he also went on to win 6 more times in that category and snag a record 11 nominations. One of his wins went to Men in Black.
Yeah!
But also, he also was the special effects artist for Wild Wild West and Batman Forever. But then again, nobody's perfect, so...
Bad movies with great special effects.
I mean, the special effects, I cannot deny, the special effects for Wild Wild West and Batman Forever are pretty fucking good.
Dude, these Batman Forever sets are, like, they're the coolest shit. They're so cool.
As much as I love to shit on Batman Forever, as a kid, I fucking loved it.
I loved it. No, me too. I mean... I loved Jim Carrey when I was a kid.
Yeah.
So him as the Riddler was like the ultimate, like, we're going to see it in movies, right, Mom? Right, Dad? We're going to see it in the movies? We saw it in the fucking movies. It was awesome. And they brought Robin in. But like, the special effects were so good.
Uh-huh.
For they still hold up because they're practical.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, crazy.
So good. Oh, yeah. That's the thing about like practical effects that I will hold on. Like, I hate the practical special effects as like a dying art.
Yeah, they look too good.
But they age better than, you know, CGI.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
that's true. They absolutely do. Like Jabba the Hutt in like those re-release of Star Wars looks like shit.
It looks so weird because I'm doing a rewatch right now because I got Disney Plus. Mm-hmm. So I
The New Hope, Jabba the Hutt.
Yeah. And you see Jabba the Hutt in A New Hope. I'm just like, what the fuck?
Yeah, dude.
Yeah.
He's all flat looking, but like old school Jedi. Return of the Jedi, Jabba the Hutt had texture and depth. Like,
yeah. But I don't know why they did that. I don't know why they went in. Because
George Lucas sucks, dude.
Point taken. Anyway, back to Videodrome. No one on the special effects team was over the age of 23 at the time of filming. They were all super young, had a chip on their shoulder, and were eager to try something new for the sake of getting a shot.
Oh, man. Cronenberg knows how to get the hungry ones, huh?
Yeah, I mean, it worked, didn't it?
It did.
So the undulating screen of the television set that Max interacts with in the film was created using a video projector and a sheet of rubbery dental dam. Rick Baker stated that, quote, "I knew we would need a flexible material. We tested with a weather balloon first, stretching it over the frame of the size of a TV screen, and pushed a hand through it to see how far it stretched, and then we rear projected onto it."
If I remember correctly in the documentary, like, they were struggling their asses off with this and had this, one guy, right?
Yeah. It was really hard to get all the moving parts kind of working.
That's what it was. It was so single, like, the way they did before.
It was also getting the rear projection to work because I could, I mean, and this is something I just noticed because when he's pushing onto it, you can tell it's a projection. Mm-hmm. But that was, I mean, it didn't bother me. I was just kind of like, whatever. So, the iconic living, breathing TV in the movie was an especially large task as the crew wanted it to be as organic looking as possible. And in order to accomplish this, they had to think outside the box. They hooked up the tubes that would push air into the TV that would stretch it out, giving it its lifelike look to a keyboard and the appropriate air valves. The crew tinkered with this for weeks on set to make it work. So basically they just really went outside the box on this, trying to make like it work. And I think one of the guys brought in like an actual pianist
who was
playing like an actual piece of music.
And that's crazy because it's like, I mean, you don't hear the sound from it, obviously.
No, but
yeah.
it gives it like this super crazy, like undulating look to it that does make it look very, very lifelike.
Yeah, like grossly lifelike. That's hard to look at.
Yeah. So kind of skipping yada, yada, yadaing through quite a bit. The final shot of the film was also the last film shot in production, as the film needed to wrap before the new year in order to keep their funding. So, filming wrapped on Christmas Eve 1981 in order to get everyone home for the holidays. And the special effects team tackled the exploding TV we see in the film. Crew members acquired sheep guts and brains from an offal factory across the street where they were filming and loaded them behind glass plating for the explosion, put air cannons behind it, and let them rip. Except that it failed hilariously. The first time, anyway. And no one at all was amused by this because it was the last scene at the end of a 12-hour shoot on Christmas Eve. Damn. Everyone was ready to go.
And this is like nasty ass guts.
They had been sitting in a bag for like a week, mm-hmm. but they had already gotten approval from like Cronenberg, from everyone on set. So it was just like, we gotta do it.
And they're just like, you know, this is gonna get worse, right? And they're like, yeah, well, this is our shoot date.
We gotta. Yeah. So they tried one more time, and that's the beautifully gruesome take we see in the movie. And with that, Videodrome, outside of some slight editing in the new year,
it was ready.
Ready to go.
It was ready. Now, how did people take it? Well, let's fucking find out. So, distributed by Universal Pictures, Videodrome was the first film by Cronenberg to gain backing from any major Hollywood studios. With the highest budget of any of his films to date, the film was a box office bomb, recouping, obviously, as stated earlier, only $2.1 million from a $5.9 million budget. Now, despite its commercial failure, the film received widespread critical acclaim, with praise directed towards the special makeup effects, Cronenberg's direction, Woods and Harry's performances, its techno-surrealist aesthetic, and its cryptic psychosexual themes.
Sure.
Yeah, it has all those things. They're
definitely there.
Yeah, they're a lot at the same time. It's very weird. So now considered a cult classic, the film is frequently cited as among Cronenberg's best and a key example of the body horror and science fiction horror genres. And again, let me just say, quick aside, I'm glad we cover such gruesomeness the first week of December every year. That's beautiful.
Well, you know, it's so funny because I was explaining to my mom, I'm like, I don't know if, because my mom is not a horror fan.
Yeah.
I think I've mentioned that about 27 million times on the show. And I was like, okay, so we have a Cronenberg Christmas thing where we cover a Cronenberg film, and it's very fun because it makes people uncomfortable. And she's like, why? And I'm like, have you ever watched a Cronenberg film? And she's like, I have no idea who that is. And I'm like, well, that's why you don't know. And and I was just like, because I like making people uncomfortable. That's why we do it, because it was my idea to do it.
Yeah.
And she just looked at me weird, and I was just like,
yeah, you just Alex gave a thumbs up, by the way.
And
you
guys smiled can't see, like an innocent, like the innocent little angel that I am.
It was like a Fallout Vault Boy thumbs up.
It was true. It was more like a Buddy Christ from Dogma. But my mom was just like, I don't understand why you like what. What's the point? And I'm like, it's just fun.
It's a holiday treat, okay?
It's a holiday treat. It is a wonderful holiday, delicious treat to kick off your December.
Oh, God.
And boy, oh boy, do we have some fun holiday treats for you guys this year.
Yeah. Surprisingly, a lot on the special effects and graphicness, but let's continue further. Yeah. The film holds an 80% aggregate rating on Rotten Tomatoes based on 49 reviews with an average score of about 7.39 out of 10. I'm a tad dyslexic.
With numbers, it's dyscalculia.
Whatever. Its consensus states, quote, visually audacious, disorienting, and just plain weird, Videodrome's musings on technology, entertainment, and politics still feel fresh today.
Which point?
Yeah, no, they kind of, they do. I mean, I feel like, again, with the context of the web world, it just medium switched.
Yeah.
You can make this movie and just switch the medium of everything over to just, you know, more tech stuff.
If it was more like the only thing that didn't age well is just the tech used.
Yeah.
But you could do like an updated version of Videodrome with like 2019
like
tech.
A MacBook and shit.
Yeah. But no, like I'm talking about like the glasses, I'm talking about like the TVs, I'm talking about the special effects. You could do the same special effects and it would still look creepy as well.
Yeah, dude. Don't watch James Woods fuck a phone.
Yeah. But no, I'm talking about the actual tech.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's the only thing. Because obviously
they couldn't have foreseen smartphones.
They couldn't have foreseen iPads, you know?
Yeah, that's true. Let's dive into a couple of these little reviews here. So on Letterboxd, the film has a 3.9 rating out of 720 reviews?
Yeah.
Fucking A. Here are the highlights. So user Lucy asks, quick question. What was this about? Sorry, Lucy. We're trying to figure that shit out, too. User Wes follows up with, Mr. Cronenberg, my dude, my pal, my buddy, buddy old pal, buddy pal friend, matey, gotta ask, what the fresh fuck? I like Wes. Wes is cool. User Julie Norwood says, quote, the line between reality and fantasy has been erased in this trippy excursion into sci-fi horror brought to you by the master of gore and body horror, David Cronenberg. A visionary masterpiece that's not only brilliant, but way ahead of its time, featuring fabulous and freaky visuals that resemble hellish hallucinations from a really, really bad trip. Julie, all right. You and your alliteration there.
I know. So what I love about Letterboxd is that you have what in the fresh fuck, and then you also have really beautiful, elegant, like, reviews, and that's what I love about Letterboxd.
It's another dichotomy of the masses right there.
It's great. Yep. But also, like, I think, in my opinion, the quick question, what is this about, is just as valid, because it's funny, and it's also, like, what the fuck is this movie about?
It's a valid summation that after 89 minutes of this movie, you might have, and people will be like, Reasonable question to ask. Anyways, Janet Maslin of the New York Times noted the film's innovativeness, and praised Wood's performance as having a, quote, sharply authentic edge.
Which is just to say, he plays a scumbag really well.
He plays a scumbag really well. No, he does. He really does. Adam Smith of Empire gave the film 4 out of 5 possible stars, calling it, quote, a perfect example of body horror. The staff of Variety wrote that the film, quote, proves more fascinating than distancing, and commended the stunning visual effects. And Gary Arnold of the Washington Post gave the film a negative review, calling it, quote, simultaneously stupefying and boring. And with that level of divisiveness and floppery, we conclude our look at Videodrome until we discuss it right now.
Yeah, so now we can kind of talk a little bit. I didn't put a whole lot of questions, but we can kind of chat about the film.
Well, luckily your first question's a lot like the first one asked by this fucking review over here. So, Alex, what the fuck?
What the fuck indeed. So, this movie, it's weird, man.
I don't, yeah,
it's a weird one.
I will say it's a good movie.
Huh?
It's a very, like, well put together.
It's an objectively
good movie.
Objectively well crafted movie. Will
yes.
I be watching it again anytime soon? Probably not.
Not soon. Maybe not even like in a year's time.
I think in like 5 years, I'll forget how I feel right now, and then I'll be like, it's been a while. I should watch Videodrome if it's like I'm really bored
streaming
on a Sunday.
Somewhere.
Yeah, and it's streaming for free. Be like, it's been a minute. I'll watch Videodrome. And then I'm going to get 20 minutes into it, and then I'll remember how I feel right now, and then I'll be like, this was a mistake. But then I'll be too far in, and then I have to
continue. You have to continue it. Yeah, absolutely. Because after that 20 minutes, it really starts. Shit just hits the fan.
Yeah. So I think that's what's going to happen. But Anthony, what the fuck?
Okay, this one disturbed me more than The Fly, for sure.
Yeah.
More than The Fly, for sure. I liked it. It was, it's a victim of pacing, I think. Definitely.
Okay, I agree. Like, the pacing, that's the only thing that I will, like, ding this movie for.
Yeah.
Because objectively, the direction's great, the acting's great,
it's fucking
the
phenomenal.
Special effects are amazing. The pacing fucking sucks.
It's just very wildly inconsistent. Like, it, like, yeah.
Yes, wildly inconsistent is a great way to explain it. Because, like, I was working on the episode while I was watching it. And I had the plot kind of all summarized while I was watching the movie. And I would be like, this doesn't make sense. How are we, like, halfway through the plot here, like, on paper, but we're only, like, 20 minutes into the movie?
Yeah.
On, like, the screen. And I'm like, that doesn't make sense. And I'm like, but it does because, like, the last 3 major plot points take, like, an hour to flesh out.
And it's all augmented by just a lack of objective reality existing.
Yeah.
And, like
which,
going in between segments.
To be fair, I mean, that's kind of a shtick of Cronenberg, where, like, towards the end of the movie... That's kind of where you're at anyway.
Well, see, this is where this and The Fly get kind of different, because I feel like The Fly had a through line. Like, he was building towards something. You can clearly tell, like, that's what it was building towards. Where this is a lot more ponderous for a good portion of the film, but in a very gruesome way.
But The Fly wasn't reality-based.
Yeah.
Like, The Fly was very staunchly
it's a straightforward
placed
story,
in
yeah.
reality.
Yeah.
And it was Jeff Goldblum's character that was, like, the one that was changing, not reality.
Yeah, yeah. Things weren't bending around him so much.
Right. Reality was static. He was the one that was changing.
Yeah. See, I mean, that's just the different concepts of the film. Like, how do you tackle that kind of shit?
Right.
Like, that... It's paced kind of like Perfect Blue, but Perfect Blue had the knowledge to make the trippiness only happen for the last third of the film.
Yeah.
Where this one's the first third of the film's your plot. And the last
two-thirds
are you
the
insanity.
Insanity.
Yeah.
I agree. Because Perfect Blue, the last third of the movie is just what?
Yeah.
And I think that's just a... I think regardless if you're going to do anything that's reality-based, the last... You know, the ending of the movie is going to throw off the pacing if you're going to go completely off the rails. Because, I mean, I had the same complaint about Perfect Blue, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
Because by the end of the movie, I'm just like, okay, like, can we wrap it up, please? Because, like, the pacing gets thrown off. Like, once you start messing with perceptions of reality, because especially in Perfect Blue, you have to see the same scene over again.
Yeah, that's true.
Like, 3 times.
Mm-hmm. And you, like, I don't know, it's weird, though, because I feel like... It's more clear with its question that it's asking in Perfect Blue.
Is it?
To me, I guess. But this one not so much because it's so tech-based and abstract comparatively.
I mean, I think this one is... I think I do agree with it being ahead of its time.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's asking a question that we should be asking ourselves now.
Yeah. But I mean, like, Perfect Blue was, like, essentially boiled down to, is this the real Mima? Or is this what's going on?
No, yeah.
Yeah, where this one's like, well, what's reality? Who are the good guys? Who are the bad guys? Blah, blah, blah. Like, there's too many other mitigating factors around the hero versus one central internal struggle.
I think that boils down to a kind of, I think it kind of boils down to it's a micro story to tell a macro theme about like where we're going in terms of our attachment to technology as a society as a whole.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
No, absolutely. Yeah.
So I think that's where I, that's what I got from it anyway, that it's one, it's a story of one group of people, but it's like a cautionary tale for society as a whole.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I feel like the macro aspect of it is probably what throws it off for me a little bit, because they still have to interject between James Wood's own struggle. Like, yeah, there's, you're actually between a couple different forces right now.
Right.
And then back to fuckery.
Yeah. That actually didn't bother me. I think I actually got a better grasp on this than I did Perfect Blue.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm the opposite. I'm flipping on that one.
That's interesting.
Yeah, yeah, right.
So, I mean, we kind of talked about it, but, I mean, your overall thoughts for the movie.
Oh, I still like it.
You still like it?
I just, I'm terrified of it a little bit.
And
again, it'll be a while before I watch it again.
Definitely.
But it does make me want to see even more Cronenberg films. Like, it has that appeal.
This, I will say, this is weird. This is kind of gross. The other ones are gross. Next year will be interesting. I think next year we're gonna have to mellow out. I think Scanners will probably.
I was thinking Scanners too.
I think we'll probably. I mean, you heard it here. Heard it here first, folks. I think Scanners will probably be the go-to for next year.
Yeah.
Because we still have, you know, we still have Crash. We still have The Brood. We still have Dead Ringers. We have quite
Dead Ringers. That's right. That's the other one I was thinking.
That's the one with Jeremy Irons playing twin gynecologists.
Okay, let's save that for year four. So, what about this movie do you think made it such a cult classic despite bombing in theaters?
The fact that it's still relevant and it still has a impactful message in 2019.
Mm-hmm.
This came out in 1983.
Yeah.
You know?
This is a long time ago.
So, we're looking, like 36
years?
Yeah.
36 years. Fuck.
Yeah.
Damn, okay.
36 years. Yeah. So it is an older movie.
Almost four decades.
Yeah.
And a still quite relevant message. I mean, you just replaced the technology basis.
Yeah, so for context, when we say ahead of its time, I mean, they're using VHS tapes, for Christ's sake.
Yeah, but their philosophy is like on extremity and the media age and consumption and what is reality when you have so much other factors determining what the narrative is.
Exactly. Like, and I mean, that goes to show even like media and like news and the 24-hour news cycle and all that stuff that we have today, where it's like, what is reality when everything, when our perception of reality is shaped by the media we consume?
Exactly. I mean, who's to say like, okay, yeah, fucking what's this guy's name? O something?
Oblivion.
Oblivion. He exists completely on VHS in this shit, but when they ask the question, like, is this more real than the flesh? Like, I actually thought about it. I'm like, well, you know, nobody's going to remember the regular guy if he wasn't on these tapes. And that is the part of him that's going to survive, essentially, a memory that he has close to him. And when those people go, he's gone.
The tape stuff and, like, having the rows and rows and rows of tapes that kind of also reminded me of the San Junipero episode of Black Mirror.
Yeah.
Where, like, your consciousness, I mean, they obviously didn't have the technology to even really fathom that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But it really reminded me of, like, that idea of, like, your consciousness being apart from your body.
Yeah.
Like, and, like, once your body dies, your mind is elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, kind of how that, again, start a podcast, live forever.
Yeah, exactly. Those are what his philosophies were. Wow.
But, I mean,
suck us out all these years.
But I mean, that makes sense, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Like, I mean, that's just kind of what I got from it. So it's all very theoretical and philosophical and also very gruesome and very weird. So
see, and they're asking these questions like, I don't know, less than a decade after Watergate and like all these things where people had like three channels to get information from and their reality is turned by around cable early, like all this shit.
And they talked about that in the documentary. David Cronenberg was like around for the beginning of television.
Yeah.
So
he was doing fucking broadcasts intercepting them in New York.
Well, yeah, from Buffalo when he was in Canada.
That's crazy.
Like, that's wild.
Yeah.
So how does this... So anyway, to answer your question, I guess the reason it became such a cult classic is just because it was able to maintain such relevancy and mm-hmm. maintain that.
It has a very concrete philosophy yeah. that's applicable to today, sure.
And it's maintained its consistency uh-huh. through since in over the last 36 years. Like, it has never been not relevant.
That, and I will also say one of the factor I think that really helps is there is no other film like this.
No.
There's just none, guys. There's, like, again, we tell you to watch, even if you probably won't like it. And definitely have, like, a Nintendo Switch or some booze around you to turn away.
Or your phone.
Or your phone or something.
Which is, like, kind of... because we're kind of, like, advocating for what this movie is preaching against.
Yeah, you're right. Goddamn fucking Cronenberg. You're right.
Like, you are advocating.
He just makes it so hard to stare at the screen.
Just suffer. You're fine.
But yeah, okay, you're not ever going to find a movie that's done similarly to this.
No, not in the same way. Like, I would say, like, there's attempts. Like, I mean, a bunch of movies try to make commentary on society at large.
Yeah, but with the mix of reality bending, it's hard. I mean, Perfect Blue's probably the closest you're going to get, to be honest with you. But that's more about fame and, like, it's very culture specific.
Yeah.
Where this is just about existence and legacy and like all those other factors. So how does this, though, as the writer of these Cronenberg episodes, how does this compare to last year's film, The Fly? How do you feel does this compare to The Fly?
I think that it's so interesting to me because The Fly still feels more mainstream to me.
Yes, significantly.
Than this, which is so interesting because, you know, Videodrome had such consistent... you know, backing.
It did. Yeah, it was an attempt to do the mainstream that The Fly kind of needed to take off.
Yeah, so I don't want to compare them mm-hmm. because they're different stories that make different points.
Yeah.
But I think, I don't know how it compares. It's a hard question.
I would say The Fly is more watchable. Much more watchable.
Yes. But I mean, that goes hand in hand with it being more quote unquote mainstream.
It is a little more mainstream, yeah. Even though the production wasn't as mainstream, obviously.
Again,
refer to our episode of The Fly last year, Cronenberg Christmas. It's like episode 12 or something.
Yeah.
10? I can't remember. 10.
It's early. Wow.
Damn.
We've come so far.
I know.
But I think that in comparison, this is a very natural evolution for us to go from The Fly to Videodrome.
Yeah, so that's true.
I think it was a good pick.
Much more abstract.
Yes. But, I mean, you know, who cares?
Yeah.
But no, I think that the comparison between the two is a little tricky mm-hmm. just because they're so different on so many different levels, right? We're looking at a mainstream plot. We're looking at weirder love stories, we're looking at weirder realities, we're looking at completely different and still amazing special effects. But I mean, they're both, but it's interesting because at the core of it, they're still both very Cronenberg-y,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Oh, absolutely. His style to a T.
Yeah, like they're still both his style, but they're still very different. And mm-hmm. they're the same but different. And I know that's an oxymoron, but it's very applicable here, in my opinion.
There's definitely have the same DNA.
Yeah.
To not, like, to throw a little punch in there.
They're siblings, but, they're not twins by any stretch of the imagination.
Absolutely. This one's actually missing 80s Gina Davis, so I'm going to have to knock it down slightly.
Oh, my gosh. It's going to lose half a point.
Losing half a point, dude. 80s Gina Davis bumps up everything.
Right, of course.
But otherwise, I would say, again, Fly is more mainstream, obviously. But, like, again, they are, I would say, this is what you're saying right here. They're good examples of Cronenberg's style done in different intentions. And they both nail what they're going for, despite making you want to look away from the TV.
Yeah.
And that's probably also part of the intention, obviously.
I agree.
But yeah, I don't know. They're kind of, again, just a Fly a little bit more because of 80s Gina Davis. And I ultimately like Jeff Goldblum a lot more than James Woods. James Woods is funny, though. I know. He's very funny. But when we get to 2019 mentality, give me Goldblum.
yeah, no, it's just... Yeah, they're so, like, I like them so much for different reasons. And again, yes. But again, I also am, like, such a huge Cronenberg fan mm-hmm. that it's really hard. It's like, you know, having to pick, like, a favorite child.
Yeah,
like,
I know.
Like, I couldn't tell you which one I like more because I like them both for different reasons. Like, there's reasons I like The Fly more than I like Videodrome. But, I mean, like, so I like the story. Like, the plot is so much more linear mm-hmm. in The Fly, and it's so much more easy to watch for that reason. For The Fly.
Yeah.
But I think I like Videodrome more because it makes more of a political statement.
It does.
It makes more of a... I think it's more impactful.
It has a philosophy.
Yeah.
It does.
Exactly.
Competing philosophies, actually. But, yeah. You know, there's underlying themes here.
I agree. Yeah.
So that's like me asking you which cat do you like?
Yeah.
Of these lovely cats.
Yeah, exactly. So...
where aren't they?
One is sleeping right on my leg.
Oh, okay.
The other one is sleeping on your bag.
Oh, every time. Oh, anyways, anything else about this movie before we wrap up here?
Watch it. I know we keep saying it, but please give it a shot.
Yeah.
It's so worth
Unless
it.
Unless you're my parents, don't watch it. I know you guys listen to the podcast. You were not going to like it. I will tell you that right now.
Yeah, if you're my dad, don't watch it.
Mm-hmm.
Please, for the love of God, don't watch it.
don't do it. It's really gross.
It's gross.
Yeah.
It's so gross. But other than that, no, I think, you know, it's worth it. It's worth, you know, the hour and 37 minutes or however long it is.
Mm-hmm.
Just watch some Chopped after if you're feeling a little icky. That's what I did. I played some Sims.
Okay.
I watched some Chopped. It was great.
I listened to a podcast on the East Coast versus West Coast rap feud and played Skyrim. So
wow.
that was my way to bring me down.
Wow, what podcast?
Slow Burn from NPR. Very good. Very good. They did Watergate. They did the Bill Clinton impeachment, and now they're doing East Coast versus West Coast, which is big difference.
I mean, the East Coast versus West Coast sounds really interesting.
It's so fucking
cool.
Because
I was very recently listening to the last podcast series on Tupac and Biggie, so
they did it too. That I love that version of it. Also, mm-hmm. that one's a lot more to the case.
Mm-hmm.
This one's a lot more
general.
Yeah, the macro implications.
Right? Did they use similar sources? Do you remember?
No, it's completely different. They go from like Source Magazine and like the actual people in the scene.
That's cool.
So yeah, not the criminal aspect of it, but just the mm-hmm. overall West Coast versus East Coast stuff. Pretty cool. Not this podcast, though.
Totally different podcast.
Yeah.
Anyway. Anthony and I have a lot of mutual interests.
That's true. Gangster rap being one of them.
I think, yeah. Which is so interesting, because I didn't get into that until I was an adult, and it was more of just like a historical interest, and now I'm just like, no, this is really good.
Yeah, so. See? And I grew up with it. I was a West Coast boy.
Yeah. I wasn't really... I mean... I am as white as the day is long, so. But just was not something I was exposed to, believe it or not. But yeah, I think that is about it before we wrap up. Rating out of 5 VHS tapes.
Oh, shit.
Actually, it should be 5 Betamax tapes.
5 Betamax tapes. Oh, that adjusts my rating completely. Yeah. I'm going to go 3.
3? Okay.
I'm going
to go 3.
Yeah.
I'm going to give it a 4.
You get a 4? Okay, cool. To me, The Fly is a 4.
Okay, I think we didn't rate it last time, mm-hmm. last year. The ratings are pretty new. But yeah, I'm going to give it a 4.
Yeah.
The Fly is a 4.5.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense.
Had a Brundle Flies, yeah.
I think if I didn't have to look away so much.
I didn't look away at all.
I looked away a lot.
That's because needles make you uncomfortable.
Needles make me so uncomfortable. They're so bad.
Well, I was like, at first I was like, what is that? I'm like, is that a fucking needle? And then I was like, oh, I guess it is. Needles don't make me uncomfortable like that. But
it's making me uncomfortable thinking about it right now.
Oh, no,
it's okay.
We'll wrap it up. But we hope you all had a fantastic Thanksgiving.
Yes, that's right.
Welcome to December. Happy Cronenberg Christmas.
Yay.
We have a bunch of lovely, lovely episodes that
holiday
are...
Holiday treats
that are... This is the most gruesome.
Yeah, it's the most gruesome.
I think.
But it's not the one with the most graphic special effects. Well, no, it's up there, actually. There's another one with graphic special effects we're going to do next week. Although it's a lot more of a wholesome movie in some parts.
Yes. But anyway, so, yeah, next week, do you want to talk about next week?
Yeah, next week is another film from the 80s. Actually, it was a year after this one. So, yeah, we're going pretty far back. It's from a director we've kind of covered, but never really not... fully, because he was working with a few other directors when we covered him, in a one of our more gruesome episodes, obviously. But this time, it's a classic that a lot of people know, and it did really, really, really well. And yeah. I watched it again recently, and it gave me all the nostalgia feels. And I forgot how graphic it was.
And I've never seen it.
You've never? Oh, then I probably spoiled a little bit by the gruesomeness of
no,
it.
No, I'm familiar.
Yeah.
Like, I'm familiar with the concept.
Mm-hmm. Okay, see, when I watch, dude, like, I used to watch it a lot, like, since having memories, this movie was in a VHS.
Wow, all right, yeah. So, we are covering it, we have an interesting docket for December.
Exactly.
So, we got some fun stuff, we got some... All I thought was a child's movie. We got
one that is a child's movie.
We got one that is a child's movie. We got some aliens in there. We got some
fucking aliens.
We got some fun shit. It's gonna be a fun December. This is probably gonna be the most gruesome.
Mm-hmm. This one definitely is.
Of the month. So if you made it through this month, or through this episode, you're solid for the rest of the month.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, I think we're good. Is there anything else you wanted to say before I go through my whole spiel?
It's cold.
It's fucking cold, and it's raining, and it's cloudy, and I hate seasonal depression, and it sucks.
Yeah, not the funnest thing in the world. I do like blankets, though.
I know.
I like blankets.
Anyway, thank you everyone for joining us for another episode of the Horrible People's Podcast. That was Videodrome from 1983, written and directed by David Cronenberg. If you like what you heard, please, please, please give us a 5-star rating or write us a review on iTunes. It means the world to us. It does keep us afloat in terms of all of the algorithm bullshit. I know it doesn't sound like a lot, but it does actually help significantly, just one review.
And Alex always texts me whenever we get a new review.
It's true.
So give her more reasons to text me, please.
He's lonely. he's laughing, but there's like tears streaming down his face.
Come on.
But if you would like to follow us on social media and stay up to date with all the latest and greatest, we're pretty active, so you can find us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. You can find us on Twitter and Facebook at Horror People Pod, and then you can find us on Instagram at Horrible People's Podcast. That is HORROR BLE People's Podcast. You can find Anthony on Twitter and Instagram at Hyrulean Hustler, and then you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Ghost Coffee Shop.
Nice.
I think that is it. Thank you so much, everyone, for joining us. Have a fantastic rest of your week. Stay warm out there no matter where you are. And until then, see you next time.
Gone with the old flesh.
Bye, guys.